is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
My next stop in the game was at Duke University with Coach K, Grant Hill and Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley. And it was a great, great time to be with Duke basketball. It was there I learned about the importance of the personal touch and about interpersonal skills and how important that is as a coach in terms of connecting with your players.
David Cooks is an author, speaker, voice talent, podcast host, and management consultant. At the age of 15, David experienced a spinal aneurysm, leaving him a T6 paraplegic and a wheelchair user. Almost in the blink of an eye, David's world went from a rising star in high school basketball to living in a rehab facility facing a lifetime of paralysis. David chose not to be a victim, rather accepting and embracing his new reality as a paraplegic to face life head on. David has spent nearly 25 years in education, including 17 years teaching at his alma mater, Marquette University High School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he taught economics and also served as the director of diversity, the coordinator of academic support, and served 11 years as the head varsity basketball coach with a record of 155-92. David served as an assistant coach at Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin from 2013 to 2018. The highlight of David's coaching career is his time spent at Duke University working for Hall of Fame coach Mike Krzyzewski and being a member of the coaching staff for USA East Coast Basketball in the summer of 2014, joining Frank Martin and Guy Rancourt in Estonia and Finland. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Sign up now for their virtual camp 2.0 featuring 10 days of workouts with pro trainers from the Dr. Dish family. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Danny Gallagher, girls varsity head coach at Magnificat High School, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Are you tired of overpaying for your video and analytics platform? Well, it's time to check out QuickCut.com, a platform built by coaches for coaches. QuickCut is undeniably more affordable, it's all cloud-based, and comes packed with features to help high schools and youth programs store, share, and analyze game film. Make the switch, get double the storage, and save your program up to 50% on the fastest-growing video editing system in the country. For more information or to request a free trial, visit QuickCut.com/basketball. That's QWIKCUT.com. Take some notes as you listen to the inspiring story of author, speaker, and coach, David Cooks. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast award-winning author, speaker, and coach David Cooks. David, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Well, Mike, I tell you what, I'm excited to be on. I've been waiting for this one for a long time.
Awesome. We are thrilled to be able to have you on. Thankful to our mutual friend, John Wilkham, for connecting us. Want to start by going back in time. You have a very interesting story. So let's start from the beginning. How did you get involved in the game of basketball when you were a kid?
I was probably like most urban kids and just loved to play. And that was the thing we did. We went outside and went to the playground until the streetlights came on, of course. And we played and played and played. And I just kind of fell in love with the game. I like the rhythm of the game. I like the competition of it. And so it was one of my dreams to just not play in the NBA or anything like that. But I really did want to play for my high school and try to help us win a state championship. And so that's kind of how I got involved. My brother played not in high school. He was more of a track star. And we had some neighbors across the street that had a basketball hoop on their garage. And that's what you did. And I just fell in love with it.
Was it always basketball for you, or was there ever another sport involved?
No, it was always basketball for me. I wasn't very good at anything else. So I'm not sure how good I was in basketball, but since there are no YouTubes from back in the day, I'm going to tell you I was outstanding.
It's a lot nicer to be able to tell those stories, right? There isn't as much video evidence as there is today, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
It's so different. I say this with my own kids all the time, and you're probably, I'm sure, the same way, that when you were growing up and we were all being photographed with film cameras, you probably have 10 or 20 or 50 family photos that you remember those family photos just because that was all there was. And now my kids will never have photos like that because there's millions and millions of photos from vacations and photos of them. It's just a completely different era that we're growing up in for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I still do have some of those pictures, and you remember, you try to remember exactly what you were doing at that place or what was going on. And it is nice to have them.
It really is. And it's just an interesting way of, I think about it, as I said, when I look back and every one of the pictures that's in my family album, when I look back at it, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember. Maybe I don't even remember the moment, but now I just remember the picture because I've looked at it so often. But my kids with millions and millions of photos, it's just their connection to their past is just in a different, it's being recorded in a much different way. So to your point, we can all tell stories about how good we were because there isn't nearly as much video evidence as there would be for a kid growing up today. When you were growing up and learning the game and getting involved in it, how did you go about getting better? Were you ever a kid that started to take it super seriously and really work on your game? Or were you just how'd you go about getting better?
Well, you know, I was fortunate enough. There was my very first coach was Coach Hines. And I played on the 7th grade or 6th grade team. I don't remember now, but we were called the Pro Keds, the Pro Kids, named after the Pro Keds sneakers. And that was my first real organized basketball situation. And he was the first coach that kind of pulled me to the side and told me he thought I could play a little bit and had some potential if I was willing to work hard. And, you know, that kind of, you know, when you hear that as a kid, you know, that just really opens up your eyes and you think, OK, what the heck? The coach pulled me over. He said he thinks I can be good. You know, what do I have to do next? And we didn't have AAU back then and we didn't have a lot of organized things. But we spent a lot of time playing, a lot of time working on our individual skills at the playground. You know, we'd have contests with who could do the best two ball drills and all that kind of stuff and lots of shooting. And so that's what really started me on improving my game was, you know, first of all, being coachable and being willing to take the instruction and the discipline from my coach at such an early age. And not only was he trying to make me a good basketball player, but, you know, as I grew up and got older in life, I realized he was actually instilling principles to make me a better person.
And I think that's one of the themes, David, that's run through our podcast is the opportunity as a coach to be able to use the game of basketball to have an influence on the young people that we're all fortunate enough to be able to interact with. And it sounds like Coach Hines had that influence on you. And sometimes I bet if you look back on it, and if he were to be able to look back and reflect on it, he may not remember that conversation in the same way that you remember it. Who knows if he even remembers it at all? And we think about how impactful a coach's words can be on us as athletes. And then conversely, we think about it from as we get older and we go switch over to that coach role. And it's important for coaches to remember how important those words are and how they can inspire. Like, here's a young kid like yourself who, yeah, you were dabbling in the game of basketball. And now suddenly, hey, an adult thinks that I can be pretty good. My coach, who I look up to, thinks I can be pretty good at this game. That's going to inspire me to work a little bit harder and go and do some more with the game. Pretty powerful.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting having coached and now had former players come back and tell me stories that I don't remember at all. They said I said something or I did something in a practice or pulled them over and said something that literally changed their life. And I don't remember it, but I'm grateful that I have the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, it's so true. I think that we as coaches, and I know Jason is a teacher and I've been teaching now, this is my 27th year. And there's so many times that you have conversations with kids and you say things and you try to give them some nugget that you think is going to have an impact on them. And obviously not everything that you say or share with a kid resonates or hits home with them. But I'm sure there are a lot of things, just like you just described, that I said or Jason has said to a kid that years later that they come back and they say, hey, I remember when you said this to me, or I remember when you had this type of influence on me through your actions or whatever it might be. And there's nothing more powerful than that, is to be able to inspire somebody who's under your direction. And I think as a coach, that's one of the things that we have to be mindful of, is not only can we have an influence in the positive way like we're talking about, but it's also very easy to discourage a kid with a couple of words as well. And so I think we have to be really, really careful of that. And so when you think back to that time and working with Coach Hines, and there were obviously other coaches in your life that had an influence on you, is there anything else that sticks out to you from either Coach Hines or one of your other coaches that is still with you to this day that has sort of influenced your life and the way you've gone about it?
Well, I think because, and we'll get into my high school situation, but up until high school, Coach Hines was probably the most influential person I had. And he told me to always do my best and to not worry about what other people thought about my game. And that was a very pivotal message for me that I still hold on to today, in terms of just making sure that when I've done what I'm supposed to do, that I've laid it all out there, that I don't have to go back and redo it. And that, you know, giving 100% into whatever I'm doing was the only way to play the game and the only way to live life. And that's the one thing that I still live by today.
Yeah, those are powerful words. And if you could live that, again, no matter what walk of life you end up in, whether that's athletics, whether that's business, whether that's education, wherever it may be, those words obviously can serve you well. For those people who maybe don't know as much about your background, you grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You ended up attending Marquette University High School. Tell us a little bit about those first year or two in high school as a high school basketball player, and then we'll get obviously into the transformational event that changed your life for forever.
Yeah. Well, you know, went to Marquette High School and was juiced up and ready to go freshman year. I was all excited to try out for the team and get the tryouts, and there's like 80 people at these tryouts. And I was like, what in the world is this? And so I said, well, I got my work cut out for me, but I believed I was going to be one of the best players. And so as the tryouts went along, I didn't make the A team, but there was a B team. So I was good. I just wanted to make a team and get started. Well, as fate would have it, I got injured as practices went on, and I ended up not making either team. And that was pretty devastating because I didn't have any other dreams in high school other than to be a good student, which if I didn't, my parents probably would have, I don't know what they would have done.
Well said.
And so that was like devastating. I was like, man, you know, what do I have to do? And so I said, you know what, I'm going to spend this off season or this summer coming up, I'm going to work as hard as I can. And I began to play with a lot of older guys and everything, and got my confidence built up and worked on the mental aspect of my game and obviously my physical body, because I thought part of my issue I wasn't mentally strong enough. You know, I think when I saw 80 people, it impacted, you know, what I thought or how I would go about that. And was I good enough to make it? And I never thought about being good enough to make it until I got in front of 80 people and had to prove myself. And so I spent a ton of time that next year getting ready. And then we had October 19th of 1979 crept up. It was a Friday. And I had just gotten a physical exam the week before from a doctor that gave me a clean bill of health to go and do whatever I wanted to do. Well, that Friday, my back was hurting a little bit. Went to school, played ball that day. I wasn't myself, but I still played and came home and laid down. And by, you know, the next morning, I was over in the emergency room and I had a blood vessel erupt on my spinal cord. And so the dream of playing for my high school ended the weekend of tryouts, because the tryouts were that Monday. And that Saturday, I ended up being in a wheelchair.
So what did, give us a little bit more for people who are listening, and honestly, for myself, as you learn more about what happened to you, what was the explanation that doctors shared with you? And then how did you react to that news and just trying to process going from what at that moment was going to be the biggest moments of your life, going to this tryout that you just spent the whole offseason preparing for, to now suddenly you're in a wheelchair? What was the explanation from doctors? And then what was your initial feeling when you first heard that?
Well, their explanation wasn't very expansive, to be honest with you, because it was just a freak thing of, you know, how you can have a blood vessel erupt in your brain or your heart or, you know, an aneurysm. Mine just happened to occur on my spine. And there was no evidence beforehand that could happen, no history in the family or anything like that. And they were pretty cut and dry and about it damaged your spinal cord and you're going to be in a wheelchair. Well, I got that news and, you know, I was like, what? You know, no, not really. You know, first of all, I'm a competitor. You know, I'm ready to go. I'm going to recover from this. And that was how I began to process it until I stayed in that hospital a couple of days. And I was like, wow, you know what? I may not be ready for tryouts. You know, and so I'm still
right. Absolutely.
I'm still thinking like, man, if I miss tryouts, I'm gonna be ticked off. Well, I ended up having to go to a rehabilitation center to relearn how to live life from a wheelchair, how to get dressed, how to go to the bathroom, you know, how to get in and out of the bed, all of that stuff. And that's when that's kind of when it set in that this was a little bit more than a backache that wasn't going to go away. When I began to meet other people in the rehab center, it kind of helped me to, first of all, it gave me perspective. I know when you're 15 years old, you don't have a lot of perspective. My roommate was a guy named Tony Otters, who was a quadriplegic. And I didn't know what that meant. But I know he couldn't use his arms and stuff real well. But his attitude was amazing to me, and his work ethic was outstanding. And he had dreams and visions and goals. And I was like, wow, if he can do that, then, you know, I can do that. And that really changed my perspective when we were in rehab together on a mat. And we were doing some things, rolling over and learning how to do all that kind of stuff. And he couldn't do any of that. And I began to say, wow, he would give anything to do what I could do. And from that moment on, I began to work hard for him and not for myself. And that really began to fuel my understanding about purpose and what my life could mean, not just for me, but for somebody else.
What do you remember about the conversations that you had with your family members when this first happens?
My family was and continues to be a strong family of faith. And one of the first things my mom and dad says that, you know, this is going to be okay. We're going to work through this together and it's going to be fine. And that was kind of the beginning of me understanding that you just have to go from where you are and keep moving. I often wonder now that I'm older, what their conversations were like at night in the bedroom of what they were going through, what they were thinking about, you know, how it impacted my brother and sisters, because it not only impacted me, but it impacted my whole family. And I just remember them always encouraging me to continue on. Don't change your dreams and goals. Graduate from high school, go to college, be successful, be a good person, because none of that changed. And that is how I ended up living my life. I mean, they did what they could to help and make the house somewhat accessible and all that kind of stuff. But what they did for me that was more important was rebuild my self-esteem and rebuild my confidence level that anything was possible.
And once you started to figure out that things were going to be okay, that you were going to have an opportunity to still chase after some of your goals, and you're looking around and saying, there are people out there that have it worse than I do, and I have to be thankful for the gifts that I do have. How did you figure out what your purpose was? How did you figure out what your next step was in terms of what you wanted to do? Obviously, all kids who are high school kids, college kids, they have dreams, they have aspirations. They think, this is what I want to do for my career. What did that process look like for you?
Well, the first process was I wanted to go back to school and find a girlfriend.
You got to have your priorities straight, I understand. Absolutely.
Exactly. I'm 15 years old. After I got back to school, I had some short-term goals and some long-term goals. And my first goal was just to graduate on time from high school with my classmates. And I was able to do that. I also began to learn at that time the importance of partnerships. I had already learned a lesson on perspective and perseverance in the rehab center. Now I knew that I didn't have to make the journey by myself. And so there were guys, and there's four guys that I still talk to this day, who helped make my high school career the best career that it could be. And absent from that was now basketball. And I was faced with the challenge of how do I reconnect to the game that I love? The guys would take me to basketball games, and I loved it. They would carry me up and down stairs, you know, because it wasn't real accessible back then. And I would just go to games and love them. And I began to understand that my passion for the game didn't become paralyzed when I became paralyzed. What I had to learn to do was take a different route to fulfill that itch I had for the game. That itch was scratched when I started playing wheelchair basketball in college. I had never played the game before. I played walking basketball, and I fell in love with that game too, because it was competitive. It was tough. You know, I was a point guard, so the ball was in my hand and I was making decisions and loving every minute of it up until I missed the national championship free throw that would have tied the game. But we're not going to talk about that.
Those are the memories that stick with you. Losses stick much harder than the wins. I know that,
Dave. Yes, they do. So as I began to kind of, and I wanted to get to college. So I think some of the dreams and goals that I had were the same as anybody would have, you know, finish high school, go to college, get a job, be a professional, those types of things. That still wasn't my purpose, though. But those were goals that I had because I didn't know what my purpose was as a young person like that. What I have found was that the journey from paralysis to purpose for me was not linear. It was a very crooked, edgy line that took me a lot of places until ultimately I realized that my purpose was tied into making the lives of other people's better. Other people, rather, making the lives of other people better. And how I could do that, eventually I found out through coaching basketball and teaching economics and ultimately becoming a public speaker.
All right. So let's dive into your decision to get into education and become a coach. What do you remember about your first experiences in the classroom and then your first experiences out on the floor as a coach? Obviously, many players have never experienced having a coach who is in a wheelchair. So it's a little bit different experience that I'm sure a lot of your players have never had the opportunity to be a part of before. So just Tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you, both as a teacher and a coach, in those first instances where you come in contact with students and with players.
Well, my first coaching opportunity actually came when I was a banker. And so I started coaching in the rec league, the men's bank rec league. I quickly learned I couldn't make them run after practice. that was not going to work. But it was an opportunity, and it kind of got me going. I had a mentor at the bank who said to me, "Man, you talk about basketball all the time. Why don't you coach something or do something?" And he recommended I do this. I did that, fell in love with the game. And I was then introduced to an AAU team here in Wisconsin back in the day that was really, really good, called the Victani Warriors. And that was my first time really coaching high-level players. We had, I think we were ranked number two in the country and had a number of high Division I players on that team. And I was like the third assistant on that team. And I didn't know what that meant, but they asked me to come and help because they thought I could make a difference. And I did whatever they asked. And it was that first experience with those guys where they valued my input. And they also began to ask me questions about my life. You know, like, how do you do this? How do you do that? They never asked me if I could coach, because I think they never asked that, because I think the coaching aspect for me was about communication. And I could still communicate and get them to understand what I was teaching. And I think that settled them. Now, back then, I would beat them in horse once in a while. I would make them sit in a chair since they thought I couldn't shoot. And we play a little horse, do a couple little things. And you know what? You get instant respect that way also. So that kind of was my introduction to coaching from the chair. And that relationship I had with the Victani Warriors and those coaches and players really began to have me think a lot bigger. Like, can I do this in college? Can I do this in the NBA? You know, what is the ceiling for me to do this? And that's where it began. And that was before college. That was after college that I started doing that. And from there, I left Milwaukee in 19. Well, I won't say when, because then you'll figure out how old I am. I left Milwaukee to get my master's degree at Duke University. And I got my master's in finance. So I was a business guy all this time. And I was fortunate enough, my next stop in the game was at Duke University with Coach K. And it was those 2 years. We talked about the lack of pictures that are taken now. I wish I would have had more sense about taking pictures during those two moments, those 2 years I was there. Because it has such great players, you know, Grant Hill and Christian Leitner and Bobby Hurley. And it was a great, great time to be with Duke basketball. I learned about the importance of the personal touch and about interpersonal skills and how important that is as a coach in terms of connecting with your players. I get this question all the time, you know, what was so special or what is so special about Coach K? And it's his people skills. I mean, clearly he knows the game, but the game, that part can be learned. But the ability to connect with players and to take the time to build relationships to the degree that you understand how to motivate and inspire each player on your team was something that I was like, wow, I had never seen that before at that level. And that really inspired me because I thought I could do that too. That, you know, I could connect with these guys. I think I could get them to do what I needed them to do on the court, et cetera, et cetera. And that that was just a remarkable experience for me. I think I learned a lot about detail, the importance of detail. I learned a lot about listening, listening to your players, listening to your staff, listening to yourself, and how important that is in terms of communication. And those are things that I took with me from there as I continued on and eventually start coaching high school a little bit later. So when I left Duke, and we can come back and talk more about that if you like. But when I left Duke, I was went up to the Northeast and was working for the largest company in the world at the time. And I was sitting there You know, instead of doing spreadsheets, I was drawing up plays, you know, and they're paying me like good money. And I'm like, you know what? This is not right and not fair to them or to me. Let me just see if there's something else I can do within the company that I had taken a head coaching job in Connecticut at a high school called Darien High School, which is not known for basketball and still is not known for basketball. But it was my first head coaching job. And I remember having to make a decision, you know, do I do the corporate thing or will this marriage work? And I had to divorce myself from the business world and go into academia. That wasn't a tough choice for me because I was following what I thought was my passion and ultimately my purpose. It cost me 70% income, which I guess is significant in the short run. But in the long run, everything paid off because money does matter, but not at the expense of purpose. So I get my first high school coaching job and we're not very good. I was used to Grant Hill and all these guys doing their thing. And I get in the gym and I don't think we had anybody that could touch the rim. And I was like, oh, my gosh, we're terrible. I had to forget about what I knew before I came in there and assess what I had and figure out how to make these guys better. Ultimately, I felt that was my job. And we did that. You know, it was a school that didn't have much respect in the conference, but we gained some respect. We didn't get a lot of wins during my tenure there, but we had the respect of the conference and our guys learned how to compete. I even had a defeated season while I was there. That's one where you don't win any games. And to this day, that was probably the most meaningful season for me as a coach because it made me search about why I was doing what I was doing and how was it that I was going to keep these guys together. Because as a coach, we may not say it, I knew going into that season that we didn't have a whole lot to work with. I thought we would win a game or two, but that would be it. So I knew I had my work cut out for me. And how do I keep the ship afloat when things aren't going well? How can I keep our guys winning even though we're losing? And that's where I learned a lot. I probably learned the most there in Darien, Connecticut. And I wouldn't trade that for any job I had because it was my first job. And it's where I learned and cut my teeth about what it means to be a coach.
I want to ask you one question about Duke, but before I do, I want to ask you about that experience of being a coach on a team that's struggling, that isn't winning very many games. And I think this is something that obviously all coaches want to be in a situation where you're winning. It's a lot easier to sell your program. It's a lot easier to get kids to buy into the culture piece of what you're trying to do when you're winning. But I often find that coaches, especially first-time coaches, you don't always get to step into a program that won 25 games the year before. You're often stepping into a program where you have to rebuild. And one of the things that I like to ask coaches that are in that situation or that have been in that situation is how do you continue to get your players to buy in, to believe in what you're doing, despite the fact that the results on the scoreboard aren't what everybody's hoping for. So what do you remember about that experience in terms of how you kept your players focused, how you kept their eyes on the process of what they were doing and not allow them to get down about the results that were happening on the scoreboard?
Well, I think we, and I say because my staff helped me with this, we wanted to create a culture of improvement. And when we got there, we knew we weren't going to be very good. So all we had was the opportunity to get better. And we talked to our kids about that all the time. We talked about, did you get better in practice today? Because that's all you can control. You can't control anything else other than you getting better today. And we lived that through that whole season. As a team, what did we do better tonight that we didn't do so well last game? And because sometimes, hear me, sometimes you can do all the right stuff and it still doesn't work out. And that's when you really, as a coach, have to get your guys to understand or your gals to understand that this is a process about growing and about learning. And I'm a big believer, and you hear it all the time now, that you're always winning if you're always learning. And how you can take those losses and turn them into learning and growing opportunities is what is the difference between having a locker room that will be on your side or one that will be against you. I also, during that time, I rewarded the behaviors that I was trying to get. And I wanted to make sure that each player on the team, 1 through 15, was rewarded for something that they did well. Whatever that gift is that they had to make our team the best it could be, I wanted to reward them with that. And I did that in many ways, you know. And so I was big on complimenting and rewarding the same way I did when I had winning seasons. I didn't change my approach. Our outcomes were different because I had better players, but the process was the same.
Yeah, I think that's really important as a coach to remember, is that if your process is the same and you stick with what you believe in, then you're going to be able to get buy-in from your players, and you're going to be able to do some of the things that you want to do in the practice environment with your team culture, that even if those results don't show up on the scoreboard, you can still have a positive basketball experience for you, your staff, your players. But to me, I think that's what it's all about. Before we move on to you returning to your alma mater to coach at the high school level again, let's go back to Duke. I just have one question for you that related to that. So you show up on the campus at Duke. How do you get connected to Coach K? How do you get involved with the program? Just what was that process like, going from, hey, I'm showing up here to get my MBA, to I'm now working with one of the best college teams in the history of college basketball?
Well, it didn't happen the first time I went to see him. I'll tell you that.
All right. So another lesson in persistence here. Is that what you're telling me?
Oh, God, yes. I remember the first time, because when I interviewed for graduate school, they flew me down and all this stuff, because my essay, I said, they asked me what my perfect job would be. And I said to be a head coach in a town that's filled with lakes, because I like to fish.
Nice.
And they were like, this is business school. I said, I know, but you asked me, so I told you. And so I said, I'm going to try to work with the Duke basketball team while I'm here too. And they frowned upon it and everything, but I was like, whatever, I can juggle two balls at one time. So I didn't know anyone when I went down to Duke in the athletic side of the house. So I went over just to try to meet Coach K. First time I go, I'm told that he's on vacation. And I'm like, all right, you know, I'll leave a note. Back then, you wrote down messages and put them in a mailbox.
Right, yep.
On a pink piece of paper, if you remember those. And
while you were out, right?
Yes, while you were out. That's right. And so I said, okay. So I decided to come back another time. And the second time, I was told he was on vacation again. And I began to think, and this is not fair to them, but this is what I thought, that they were blowing me off, that they weren't going to give me a chance. And so after that second time, I remember being at the business school and I was about to go in, and I saw Tommy Amaker walking down the stairs. Tommy's the head coach at Harvard now. And Tommy was leaving the business school and had just left and gone full time on Coach K's staff. So I stopped him in the parking lot and introduced myself. And he was kind enough to stop, because he didn't have to. And I told him I was from Wisconsin and blah, blah, blah. I want to kind of help with the team. And I've been trying to meet Coach K, and I'll do anything and all of that. And he asked if I had a resume. And I did not. But what I did have was some articles that had been written about me when I was coaching our AAU team in Florida. And I gave him that. And then we left. I didn't hear anything. And I said, well, you know, school's about to start in a few days. Let me go back over and try this one more time. Well, this time I get there, and his secretary says, well, he's not available. And immediately I said to myself, she didn't say that he was on vacation. She said he wasn't available. So that means he's in town. So I'm like writing another message for him. And before I leave, there's a guy in the office. I have another Tony in my life. It was Tony Lang from Alabama. And he said, hey, man, aren't you the guy from Wisconsin? And, you know, I hesitated to respond because I wasn't sure. You know, I just wasn't sure what that was about. And so he said, hey, I saw you down in St. Petersburg, Florida, coaching an AAU team from Wisconsin. and I loved how you interacted with your players. Are you here to help us? And immediately I told him I was from Wisconsin, and I said it very loud. And I said, absolutely, I'm here to help if I can get the opportunity. And it turns out, and I tell coaches this because your integrity and your character really do matter. And I didn't know who was watching me in St. Petersburg, Florida, because that wasn't why I was coaching. I was just, again, doing what I do. And so I got an unsolicited testimony from one of the players of the team in the office. Nothing happened. I left, you know, and eventually, as fourth time, I'm like, all right, I got to go try to see him. And so I go, and as I'm coming down the hill toward Cameron Indoor Stadium, I see Coach K walking in toward the building. And I'm in my wheelchair, of course, and I roll down that hill as fast as humanly possible. I look back at it and I wonder how I didn't fall out of my chair. I mean, I don't know what happened, but I was so determined to meet him. And we met at the door of Cameron Indoor Stadium. And he said, I said, hey, I'm Dave Cooks. And he stopped me and he said, oh, I know who you are. I've been meaning to try to get a hold of you. Do you have time to talk? And so we met that day. Tommy Amager had given him that article. Excuse me. And we met that day, and Tommy Amager had given him the article. And that article was the same article that Tony Lang was talking about in St. Petersburg, Florida. We sat down and talked. They didn't have a position for me. And he said, but you're more than welcome to come to practice for this year. I did that for that first year. Didn't miss a practice. I paid my way to some of the greatest venues of the game. He would let me go on trips, and I paid for them all. I remember UCLA was like one of the biggest places. I was like, I got to see this. I got to see it. So I was able to do some of that kind of stuff that first year. The second year, I come back after the summer. I had an internship up in the New York area. And he pulls me in. He says, hey, we'd love to have you be a part of our program this year. And but the only thing I can do is you can be a manager. And Jay Billis was the grad assistant my first year, and he had finished up, and that position no longer was available by the NCAA. So he said, would you be willing to be a manager? And I knew that meant making Gatorade, running down loose balls, and doing laundry. But I also knew that I would be gleaning from the greatest of all time, arguably. So I took it. I told him, absolutely, I'll do that. Well, I wasn't a manager for long before, as he would say, well, we found out you know a little bit about the game. So why don't you help us out with practice plans and coaching and that kind of stuff? And that's what led me to be a part of the program. And I often wonder what would have happened, A, if I wasn't persistent, and B, if I had said no to being a manager. I think my life would have been totally different.
Those are two great lessons, David. I think when I think about the conversations that we've had with coaches on the podcast, that persistence is so important, and just that ability to be willing to do whatever it takes in order to get your foot in the door. Those are two persistent themes that have come through when we've talked to coaches that, look, you're not going to always have that first door open up for you. You got to keep coming back and keep knocking on the door and keep knocking on the door. And eventually, you're going to get through it. And then the second piece is just being willing to do whatever it takes. I mean, I can't even count the number of coaches who said, you know, I was sleeping on a mattress in some house in a basement. I was making next to nothing. And I loved every single second of it because I was getting to do what I always wanted to do. And I think there's a tremendous lesson there that you obviously learned, you applied it to your life. And I think it's something that's applicable to certainly to coaches, and it's probably applicable to anybody in any walk of life that when doors close on you or when doors seemingly are closed, if you keep working at it, sometimes you can get them open. And then that leads to some unbelievable experiences. So I have two questions related to that. I know I said I only had one Duke question, but now I'm going to keep going. So my two questions are, what's your favorite game memory from that time? And then number two, who from Duke at this point do you still have a relationship with? Who were you able to make a connection with during your time there?
I think the greatest moment was the shot, the Kentucky shot that Leitner made. And I wasn't even at that game. I know exactly where I was. I know
during that shot. I know exactly where I was sitting. I know exactly who I was with. Incredible.
I was sitting at home and coach had asked me if I wanted to go to the game. And I said, well, you know, I have an interview the next morning. I've got to fly out early and I need to, you know, I'm going for this job interview. So I'll just catch the next thing. So I'm sitting there watching this game in my apartment in Durham, North Carolina. And I'm like, this is the craziest thing I have ever seen. And when they got back on campus, that was even crazier. Traveling with those guys was like traveling with the Beatles or a rock band. It was so much attention to everything. But that shot, and the reason I say that shot, and I wasn't even there, is because practice every day was at such a high level that I enjoyed going to practice because I wasn't sure what I was going to see that day. I didn't know what kind of move I was going to see, what kind of defensive stop was going to happen. I didn't know what kind of fight I was going to see. I mean, so because those guys were competitive but they were, when it was over, they were boys. They were absolutely boys. And so, so that as a spectator kind of quasi coach, the other one was the national championship up in Minnesota, 1991. To be there for that Final Four. That was my first experience at the Final Four and to be a part of them winning that second championship, the back-to-back year. That was amazing. That was amazing. And that was my first year that it wasn't even the second year when I was actually a manager. They allowed for me to go and be a part of that. That was amazing.
Very cool. Yeah. That's awesome.
Who do I keep in touch with now? Coach K is probably of all the people, he's such a genuine and nice guy, you know, at least to me he is. and I think he is to most people. But we keep in touch. Lately, you know, over the past few years, I used to go down for my wife and I. My wife and I even got engaged at halftime of his 700th game. He was at home against Georgia Tech. And we used to go to games fairly regularly until I start coaching high school basketball and kind of got busy. So I keep in touch with him. Once in a while, I talk to Bobby Hurley and Tony Lang is coaching in the league. And then Quinn Snyder, who was my classmate and I was the head coach at Utah. We touch base from time to time, too. The other guy that, you know, we kind of keep in touch is a guy named Marty Clark. And Marty Clark was from Denver and he's doing some remarkable work in that area, helping people with drug addictions.
It's amazing the different paths that people go on. And just you think about how long Coach K has been at Duke and just the legacy that he's wrought there, not only as a basketball coach, but just his impact on people. And just like we've talked about, and it's been something that has been a driving force in your life. And I think that the best coaches have that in mind, that what kind of legacy am I going to leave? Not just on my one loss record, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond what the scoreboard says. It's what impact can I have on the people that I'm dealing with every single day? And it's just such a powerful thing that we have as coaches. And what a great experience for you to be able to be a part of that and to be able to be influenced by Coach K and the other great people that have been part of that Duke program, and then to take what you learned and go out and share that with the young men that you were privileged enough to be able to coach. Let's talk a little bit about returning to your alma mater to be the head coach of the boys varsity basketball team there. Tell us what that experience was like.
Wow. Hey, before I do that, there is one, sure. One other moment, and it wasn't a game moment. It was and this is kind of emotional. I'm trying to keep it together. When Coach K brought Jim Valvano to practice, and Jim Valvano was sick with cancer. And I remember getting a chance to meet him and to see the love that Coach had for him, even though they competed against each other as coaches and all of that, and bringing him to practice and having all of the program experience that moment is something that I will never, ever forget. On to Marquette High School. I ended up leaving the Northeast. I had an opportunity before coming home to join a Division I program out in California. But it just, I didn't know how I would make it. I was in a wheelchair. They didn't have a lot of money. I didn't know about living in a dorm and all that kind of stuff. So I opted not to do that, and ended up coming back to Milwaukee to work at my alma mater, Marquette High School. Now, when I came back, I did not want to coach. I wanted to take a little break, to be honest with you. I had run some AAU programs out east, and I was on the staff of Hoop Group and did some stuff with Five Star, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was doing a lot of basketball and having a lot of fun with it. But I wanted to go to the grocery store and not have anybody know who I was. I really wanted that. Knowing that they would know who I was because I was in a wheelchair. So it's not like you can't know.
A little harder to hide in that respect, right?
A little hard to hide. But at least I wouldn't be coaching. And so I get there and I meet with the head coach, and he's like, hey, you know, would you be interested in coaching JV? And I thought about it, and I said, you know, yeah, sure, I'll do that. You know, I can do that. It's not varsity. I'm not the guy. I love to do this. So I began coaching them and loved it. It was a great experience. And then my head coach moved on to something else, and the job was offered to me. And it was therapeutic in a way. Because the same gymnasium that I never got a chance to play in, I now was a coach in. And I can't explain to you the feeling I got every game, every practice I went to that gym. Because it was like what I didn't get to have, I was now having at an even greater and higher level. And so I was so excited to get the job, and we had a winning tradition, and I knew the pressure would be great. I was obviously the first coach in a wheelchair to be a head coach in the school history and all of that, and also the first African-American head coach. And so with that, I knew would come some questions and some concerns and some issues. And there were people who actually questioned my resume. They thought I hadn't been at Duke. They actually called down there to make sure I wasn't making that up. And I was like, seriously? Which is okay. And I tell you what, we won games. I think we ended up winning close to 70% of our games, which is not a bad number when you came from winning 20% of your games. And we ended up making a run to the state tournament for the first time in the school's history since the private and public schools had combined. And I was pretty proud of that. During that time, I began to teach economics at the high school. And it was in the classroom that I began to understand I was gifted to reach people and to reach young people, especially, and that I could speak into their lives and help change their destiny, so to speak. And I saw it there, and I saw it on the court, and I saw that I was a teacher and an educator on the court and in the classroom. And that's when I began to find my groove and kind of understand, I think this is my purpose. The game was my passion, but my purpose was to serve and make other people better. And I kind of figured that out. The classroom helped me get that. And when I was able to translate that fully onto the basketball court, it was great until I got fired. And I got fired. I couldn't believe it. I mean, we had been there 14 years, and we were coming off a couple of down years, but we were loaded. We kind of kept our young group together and all of that, but they wanted to go in another direction. I had never been fired before. I thought I had done a good job. There were no skeletons in the closet, no improprieties. The players had good experiences. And I really didn't have an answer. It was almost like having the aneurysm on my spine. I really didn't have an answer, you know? And so that was a difficult moment. I had to really reflect, regroup, and relaunch. Because anytime you have a traumatic situation like that and things don't go your way, and coaches can probably understand this, you know, I just want to assess, because I felt I still had some gas in the tank, but I needed to assess and see, you know, what were my successes? What were my failures? Is there some truth in what's happening here? And how can I grow from this? I had to take the same ideas and theories that I was sharing with my players and now apply it to myself. How do you learn from a loss? How do you move forward? Because there are more games to play. And I did that. Now, honestly, you know, I wanted to punch the guy in his throat when he said it.
I can imagine.
Yeah, but I didn't, but I wanted to. But I knew that would solve nothing other than, you know, that would solve nothing. And so the challenge coming back after vacation, it was right around Easter break when that happened. And I come back to school and having to be in the building with these same people that had just ushered me out was probably the greatest challenge I've ever had in my life in terms of having to learn how to be peaceful and get along when things just are ugly. But we were able to do that. And I realized that they had moved on. They were interviewing people to replace me while I was still trying to be mad at them. And when I realized that they had moved on, I'm like, you know what? I need to forgive and move. I don't need to stay in this place. I stayed at the school and taught economics, but I needed to get in a different mental state than where I was. And, you know, as life has it, you know, I got a call from someone that heard I had been let go. And then I became an assistant coach at Concordia University here in Wisconsin, a Division III school. And I had not been back on the college sideline since I left Duke. And now I was, one of the primary recruiters. So I was loving that. So it hadn't ended the way I wanted at Marquette High, but it ended in a way that helped me to move forward to experience some things that I would not have done. Coaching at Concordia University was one of them. And just before starting to coach there, I went to Europe to help represent the USA with USA East Coast basketball with Frank Martin, who's down in South Carolina, and Guy Rancourt, who's now at Western Connecticut. And we took some guys over to Europe and to Estonia and Finland and to play in some games. And I would not have been able to do that had I still been at Marquette High School, because I would have had summer responsibilities. So there's lessons in all these things that can happen.
When you think about obviously getting fired at your alma mater, it's not something that I'm sure you envisioned when you first started there. But as you said, it opened up some other doors. You get the opportunity to be an assistant coach at Concordia. You get the opportunity to travel to Europe and have that experience. What do you remember about that assistant coaching position at Concordia in terms of how you handled being an assistant after having been a head coach, where you go from being the guy who it's your program, you're making those decisions. And obviously, it's at a different level, but now you're an assistant coach and you're back to being a guy offering suggestions instead of a guy making those decisions. So how did you adapt to that? Was it a difficult transition? Was it easy because you had already sort of processed what was going on? Just what was your thoughts there?
Well, I had been an assistant before, but it had been as a manager for Coach K. And over the years, having been a head coach, I knew what I wanted out of my assistant coaches. And because of that, when I went into Concordia, I just wanted to fill any gap that the coach may have needed. And I didn't want, look, I'd been a head coach. And so that wasn't an aspiration anymore. I was happy being a coach on a team and having a role to fulfill. I try to live what I preach. And I used to talk to our players always about fulfill your role, do your job, because your job is your job. And when I got to Concordia, it was interesting, you know, because I was in a wheelchair. We had to talk about, I remember the first meeting we had. He's talking about, you want to do offense, you want to do defense, you know. I said, whatever you like for me to do. And eventually we got around to recruiting. I said, well, you know, I think I can recruit for you. I've been around and I know a lot of people and I think I can help with that. And he said, well, how do we get you on a bus? And so here I am thinking, oh, I'm like, what the heck? I think I got the job. And so we worked through some of those things. I said, well, they've got these buses with lifts on them now and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, if there's some real issues, I can always get there. And so we've begin to work through some of the logistics of it all. And the basketball took care of itself. I just wanted to make him better. I wanted him to be the best head coach that he could be. And if there were things that he didn't do well that I could do well, I would do those and try to help him get better at that. And that's how I approached being an assistant coach. I also learned when I was at Marquette High School, and this was a hard lesson for me to learn. I had an assistant coach, Neil O'Connell. I had a great staff, Neil and Mark Briggs and those guys. But Neil O'Connell had come from another part of the state. And I really liked him. I hired him as an assistant. And he was a huge 1-3-1 zone guy. And he came from a place that had run that and won all these state championships and everything. And he kept talking to me about this 1-3-1 zone because we had long athletic guys. And when we got out of our conference into this state tournament, we were facing really good athletic city type teams. And they would just be too much for us. And, you know, he was on me about that. And I didn't listen to him for a couple of years. And the reason I didn't listen to him is because I didn't know how to run it, quite honestly. And once I kind of swallowed my pride and I actually said to him, I said, Neil, look, I think you're right. I don't know how to run this. Why don't you? This is your responsibility. I'll sit back and learn how to run this from what you teach our guys. And he did that for a year and a half or so for us before I could understand how the ins and outs of that 1-3-1 zone. That's what I brought with me when I went to Concordia. The importance of listening and adding in and not having such a big ego. I'm here to serve. Coaches are there to serve. If you really frame it in that way, it will keep you grounded in a place where you can really grow and help others to grow.
That's well said. I think when you can keep your ego out of it and understand that it's about serving, whether it's your head coach or serving the players that you're working for, I think that's when we end up getting better results. When did you start to formulate the idea behind David Cook's Enterprises and thinking about your public speaking, thinking about writing the book, thinking about getting started with the podcast, some of the things that you're doing now? When did those ideas start to percolate in your mind?
It was in 2016. I was sitting down in the kitchen with my wife and I said to her, I said, you know what, hon? I think that my assignment is up at the high school. I don't know what I'm supposed to do next. You know, I've been there now for 17 years and I had not coached there for 3 years. And I just told her I wasn't sure, but I think I'm supposed to leave. And she said, well, you're okay. You know, if that's what you think, then let's see what happens. And I remember telling the guys the last day of class, you know, I thanked them for all the support over the years and stuff. And I said, I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, guys, but I know I'm supposed to write a book. And I think I'm supposed to speak to people. And that's how I left the high school. And I didn't know how to do any of that. I'm not a big writer or a reader. I'm more of one now than I was before. And I began this journey of being uncomfortable again. And I believe that sometime we learn most when we're most uncomfortable. And I learned how to sit down and write this book. I made a bunch of mistakes, got it right. It's interesting. I didn't write the book until I had a near-death experience in December of 2016. I was on my way to Boston. I was flying to give a speech in Boston. I had just gotten hired by a speaking agency, and they wanted me to come out, just give 10 minutes to this group, and then afterwards we'll have a handshaking time and try to get you some contracts. Partly on my way there on that flight, partly halfway there or so, I began to have trouble breathing. And I remember the flight attendant came and asked me, you know, did I need oxygen? And, you know, I was like, well, oxygen's never killed anybody, so I'll take that. And so I took it and I said to them, if you could just have an EMT waiting for me when we get off here, because I've got about 3 hours in between when I land and when I'm supposed to speak. And I just want to get to an ER and make sure I'm okay. I thought it was some sort of flu bug or something. Well, it turned out I had submassive blood clots in my lungs. And I did not give that speech that weekend and ended up in emergency room getting some surgery done that saved my life. As I was in the ICU, because there were no hospital beds anywhere in the hospital, one of my former students was a doctor there. I didn't know that. They heard I was in the hospital and they came to see me and they began to share my story a little bit with some of the staff there. And then my first manager on the team at Marquette High School, his name is Steve Bodie, and he's a soccer coach now. He was actually coaching at Brown University. He came up, he heard I was in the hospital, and he came and visited me in ICU. And he began to tell the staff about Coach K and all this other kind of stuff. And I was like, why do you do that? So here they are coming in. So now I'm in ICU, tubes everywhere. And I'm a famous guy.
now you're the center of attention.
Now I'm the
right?
center of attention. And so the doctor said to me, and my wife, she had just come in, and he asked where was my book, and I wasn't sure. I'm like, I didn't know what he was talking about because you know I'm in ICU and I don't know if he means a book or does he mean a book. I don't know. And so he said to my wife, well, he needs to really write a book. You know, we've heard so much about what he's done. And I said, okay, you know what? I told the guys I thought I was supposed to write a book and speak, and I was. But I think I was on my journey to purpose, but I was out of order. I was supposed to write the book first and then start speaking. So I canceled everything when I got back home and sat down and wrote the book and published it in 2018. And that experience was a challenge just because who do you think is going to read it? But then as I begin to write and begin to go back and think about stories and things that people could relate to, I began to realize how blessed my life really is in all of these different experiences that I had, you know, the Duke experience, the Concordia, being a banker, you know, all that stuff. And I was like, wow, you know, because oftentimes unless you get a forced stop like I did, you don't really stop and look back at your journey. And I'm just grateful that I did. And that's really what has inspired me to keep going, even in these times where, you know, the speaking market has dried up to virtual speaking for the most part with COVID and those types of things. But you move forward and you reinvent yourself. And we talk about the pivot in basketball. And I believe that footwork is the most important skill you could have in the game, because if your feet are right, you can't be defended. And so pivoting is so important now. Before I started the podcast, I know this sounds crazy. You're like, how much stuff have you been through? It was late 2019. I had just gotten off the circuit, had a great speaking year, was on some big stages, finished a speech here in Milwaukee, and that was it for the year. And I wasn't feeling great, and I thought I had the flu. So I told my wife, I said, let's go to the ER. I just don't feel great. I get there, and they tell me I have sepsis. Now, I don't know what sepsis is. So I'm like, well, all right, whatever. Let's get this done so I can get back to, you know, whatever we have to do. And they're like, well,
may not be all that fast.
May not be as fast as you like. So in the midst of 120 days of full bed rest, I had a lot of time to watch YouTube, reflect, and think. And during that time, I also took some options trading classes, but that's another conversation. during that time, I began to think, how can I get this message in my book to people? And so I put together with a friend of mine a series called Insights from Getting Undressed, because the name of the book is Getting Undressed from Paralysis to Purpose. And it was a 16-week series where I interviewed people from all over the country who had read this book to get their insights, to get what it was that motivated them. In the midst of doing that, I was so encouraged and so moved by, I didn't know the impact that my book in my life was having on the people who read it. Had no clue. No clue. It was kind of like that coach player thing. You know, you come back, you're like, oh, I don't remember saying that.
Absolutely.
And I was having that experience. And so that was all going on. Then COVID hit. So where do you go? Well, I was like, you know what? I need to write another book, which I still need to do. But then I said, I'd like to do a podcast, call it Paralysis to Purpose, and feature stories that of people who have gone from difficult moments, got through that, and are now fulfilling purpose by serving others. And with that as the theme behind what I was doing, I start sending emails to whoever I thought had a great story. And they begin to say yes at a very high level, which was amazing to me. And so we launched the podcast this past June, and we are about to go into season three. And our lineup is amazing. So I'm just grateful for these opportunities. And I'm glad that I've learned to be open to growth and to change. As a coach, I think those are two things you need to have in your life, to be open to growth and to change. Because if you don't, you'll be trying to run the offense from 1930 and you lose the 3-point shot game.
There's no question about that. It's an interesting turn of events for you and just the different twists and turns that your life has taken. And yet, all the while, it seems like you were headed in this direction of being able to use your life to have an impact on others. And I know the podcast, one of the things that struck me about what you said that I can completely relate to is once you had the platform to reach out to people who maybe you thought, oh, that person may not want to come on, or they may not want to share their story, or maybe they're going to say no. But once you have the platform, it becomes a lot easier to ask. If you were just going to call up and try to have a conversation with somebody, but you didn't really have a reason or a purpose or a platform, it's a lot harder. But once Jason and I kind of had this podcast up and going and we had interviewed some people, suddenly it got a lot easier to reach out to people and ask and say, hey, do you want to come on? And it's very rare that we get somebody that says, nah, I don't want to do it. Now, sometimes we can't reach certain people depending on how big they are. but most often, if we can reach them, they often say yes. And I think that's probably the same thing that you're experiencing. I want to ask you just one question about the podcast, and that is, when you think of the episodes that you've done to this point, is there, and you don't have to pick out your favorite guest. I don't like it when people ask me that question because you can't really narrow it down. But is there a particular lesson that one of your guests shared with you that had a particular impact on you as you're interviewing them?
Wow, that's I think of the difference between, in fact, it may have come from this week's podcast, the difference between moving on and moving forward. And I didn't know what that meant. And the guests began to talk about sometimes you can't move on from a situation because it's so traumatic, but you can deal with that and move forward and leave that where it is. And I just thought that was so profound from someone who had had such a devastating loss in his life. The ability to move forward and the difference between that and moving on. I just thought that was amazing. I mean, I could probably go through a number of stories because we've had, it's amazing. And you know this as a podcast host, a person's story is the most powerful thing they have. And when you begin to hear some of the stories of people and the things that they've gone through, that you think you do your research, but you really don't know everything. And you're like, oh,
absolutely.
You're like, oh, my goodness, this is amazing to me. And so, but that was pretty profound. The importance of knowing how to move forward. And that takes a lot. It takes forgiveness and a bunch of other things when you've been mishandled and mistreated, and how to move forward. I kind of learned that when I got fired at Market High School. I had to move forward.
It's a powerful message. And I think it's one that anybody who's gone through adversity in their life, which is everybody at some point, varying degrees of adversity, But to be able to take that lesson and apply it to your own life, I think is one that can be very powerful. Before we wrap up, David, I want to give you an opportunity to share where people can find out more about you. How can they connect with you? Where can they get the book? Where can they listen to the podcast? It is your chance to give your 1 minute elevator pitch. Give us everything you got, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you for this opportunity. And hopefully we shared something that will inspire your audience. If people want to get a hold of me, I have a couple of websites. One is davidcooksspeaks.com. And then our podcast website is paralysis2purpose.com. I'm on social media at DCE Speaks, LinkedIn, David Cooks MBA. And if you're interested in getting a copy of my book, which is called Getting Undressed from Paralysis to Purpose, it's on Amazon, but also you can get it off my website. If you'd like a autographed copy, you can get it there. I think that's really it. You know, I love to speak at your organization. I love doing coaches clinics to talk about all kinds of things because I still have that coach in me. You know, it's funny. as much as my wife coached, and she actually played Division I basketball at Fairfield University. And we're both not coaching now. This is her first year not coaching. And I don't miss. I think it was time for me to stop that part of it. But coaching coaches is something I really love doing, too.
That's good stuff and well said. David, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. You have a very, very powerful story. Anybody who's out there who's a part of our audience, if you get a chance to pick up a copy of David's book or listen to his podcast, please do so. Again, David, thank you. And to everyone who's a part of our audience, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.